ある山間の小さな村に侍の墓が4つ並んだ。
Let's make seven samurai, ten samurai, on the Cut Print Film Podcast number 57. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave and Chris.
Greetings, true believers, and welcome back to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 57. I'm one of your many hosts, Chris Evangelista.
I'm Jeff Rollins, another one of your hosts.
And I'm David Costell, per use. That's my new catchphrase.
I like it. All right.
I think you should scrap it.
Testing it out.
We are a film podcast, and we run
Who's
a
Phil?
Well, he's nope. my... nope. He's my shoe salesman. We run a website called cutprintfilm.com. We have movie reviews and editorials and interviews. You name it, we got it.
Yeah.
And we took a week off because we picked a very long movie to talk about, but we're back. Might be a little rusty, so bear with us.
Yes. Yeah, this is the best of the Cut Print Film Podcast.
No, it's not. That's confusing.
This is a brand new episode. Episode 57. Well, this is our 57th variety.
Yes.
How do you guys know, though? It might be.
How do I know? Because I'm here doing it.
This might be the best podcast we've ever done.
Not so far.
I see. I understand.
Okay, so what's next?
Well, so in the world of film, an old movie came out this week, sort of brand new. Drafthouse Films re-released the film Roar.
What year did that come out originally? Or did it ever come out?
No, it did come out. It came out in the 80s, and I'm sorry I don't have this up.
What's the 1880s.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it's very
that is
old.
It's groundbreaking.
It's very old.
I know. It's hard to watch. It's in black and white. So Roar was a film. It was made by Tippi Hedren of The Birds fame, mm-hmm. and her husband, Noel Marshall. They were animal rights activists, I guess you could say, and they loved big cats, like lions and leopards and tigers.
Fat cats.
Yeah, fat, yeah.
Like the Lehman Brothers.
Like Boss Tweed from Tammany Hall. And so they got it in their heads. They were going to make this idea. They were going to make this movie with real lions, and they weren't going to train the lions. They were just going to make a movie.
Why bother?
Yeah. Well, they didn't want to, they didn't want to torment the lions by training them, because that's, it's not as animal friendly as it could be. You have to force them to do things they don't naturally do. So they made this movie, and it was a disaster from beginning to end. It went over budget. It took them 11 years to finish the film.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. Definitely a solid investment for everybody involved.
Well, the Lion Union got involved.
Mm. So the tagline that Drafthouse Films is using for the re-release is, no animals were harmed by making this film, but 70 humans were. So over 70 crew members were hurt during the making of this film, including the cast, where Melanie Griffith was in the film. She's Tippi Hedren's daughter. And she was actually mauled in the face by a lion. And that's actually in the film. You see it happen. Wow. She had to have reconstructive surgery on her face. Jan de Bont was the cinematographer. He went on to direct Cliffhanger and, the films like that. But
classics.
He was actually scalped. And there's a photo. There's a photo on the Drafthouse Films website where you see his head is just like
looks like somebody stepped on his foot and the top of his head opened like a trash can lid.
Well, it's post-surgery where he just has he had 220 stitches in his head.
Wow.
From this
and he was like, this was worth it.
When the film came out, it was, it bombed basically because it cost a lot of money to make and no one saw it, but it sort of has this cult following now, and now Drafthouse is giving it this big, not big, but this fairly recognizable re-release. And,
it's sort of an ironic release.
Yeah, it's a tongue-in-cheek release, if you will.
The trailer, I watched the trailer. It's a funny, funnily edited trailer. Right. Animals attacking the actors, and then a voiceover just saying, roar.
Yes.
It's really absurd.
So it cost $17 million to make this movie, and it only made $2 million worldwide when it was
released.
I like
it.
Well,
that's the kind of profit you want from a film like that.
And you get that guy as our CFO. Yeah.
So there's no real plot to Roar. It's basically Noel Marshall directed the film. He's in basically the whole film is his family, Tippi Hedren and their kids together, and Melanie Griffith, and he plays like a wildlife. They don't even say what he is. Basically, he lives in Africa in this house, and the house is just filled with lions. Mm. and his family is coming to visit, and he forgets to pick them up at the airport. And that's pretty much the whole plot. So it's him. They're trying to get to the house. He's trying to get to them, not realizing they're coming to the house. Oh. So they get to the house while he's out looking for them.
Oh, it's a regular Three's Company episode.
For some reason, he neglected to tell them the house is filled with lions.
With murderous felines.
So they show up, and the lions just attack. There's literally an hour where they're running up and down the stairs, and the lions are chasing them, and they're hiding in barrels, and they're hiding in closets. It's like a Three Stooges.
It's like Benny Hill music.
It's not, but like, it's funny, but it's also fucking terrifying because These are real lions, and you can see how terrified the actors are because it's not acting. Literally, there'll be scenes where characters are giving their lines, and a lion will just knock them down. And these people, they're such pros, they keep giving the line as they're, so they'll just be like, we have to, and they just get back up and continue the line like nothing happened.
I don't know if I could watch this without having a panic attack.
Basically, this is like, it's like a YouTube cat video mixed with Faces of Death. That's what this movie is. And it's just, I watched this in sort of stunned silence as it unfolded. Just, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it's just, it's insane. It's utter lunacy.
Sounds
from
insane.
Beginning to end.
Sounds
so
nuts.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
Were any granimals hurt in the making of this movie?
I don't know what that is.
Is that a graham cracker animal, yeah. I'm assuming?
Yeah.
All right. Well, you don't have to answer that question.
I
thought.
I asked it for the fans.
Yes, the granimal fans out there. So, yeah, it got a very limited release. It came out in Philadelphia here on Friday. I don't know how long it'll be here, if it even is still here. Mm. It's playing at Draft House Theaters across the land. We in Philadelphia are not blessed with a Draft House theater yet, unfortunately, but
we're starting a petition to get one here.
I would love that to happen. Sign
we have three signatures.
Yeah,
won't you sign our petition?
Ironically, they're not from us. They're from all our moms. So if you're lucky enough that a Draft House is in your location, go see this. If not, I believe they are going to give it a big Blu-ray DVD release soon. Yeah. So it's really worth seeing just to see how utterly bonkers this film is.
All right.
Nice.
So what did come out this weekend, wide release?
That's new.
Ex Machina.
Yes. Oh.
The Robo film.
Yeah.
It's starring...
starring RoboCop.
Yes, Robert Cop.
Was there Robo tripping in this film?
Mm. You saw it, so you would know.
I know,
why are you asking?
Well, we didn't tell them at home yet, so...
So it's written and directed by Alex Garland, right. Who wrote a bunch of movies, you know.
He wrote Dread...
28 Days Later.
That's right.
Sunshine.
Yeah.
He's also he wrote The Beach, the novel The Beach.
Oh.
Yeah. And the screenplay.
Yeah.
All
right. He's a Renaissance man, if you will.
Yeah.
Yes. He's a regular Danny DeVito in Renaissance.
Yes.
Man.
Taught all those army kids about poetry.
But this is his first time directing a movie. And it's kind of a simple movie, you would say that, right?
It's deceptively simple because there's all these themes going on beneath it, but it's there's only three characters, well, four characters essentially.
Yeah.
They're all in one location,
and at times I felt like it could have been a play.
Yeah, sort of, yeah, I could see that.
I haven't seen Ex Machina, so go over it scene by scene in great detail.
Okay.
Yeah, let's try not to spoil it too much.
Yeah, I guess because
it's new and we want you to go out and see it.
Yeah.
It's cool. Like, the coolest part about it, though, is how small it is, but how much it accomplishes in that.
For a first time director, this is a home run. I can't believe this is like his first. It's so well directed.
Yeah, the same way Dan Gilroy blew me away with Nightcrawler being his first movie, this is a similar situation where this guy directed this movie and you're like, oh my god. And it also reminded me of Duncan Jones's Moon a little bit.
Yeah, it's similar to that where it's very
claustrophobic and a little sterile in like a good way.
It's like minimalist but not. So who's in Ex Machina?
Alicia Vikander.
Right, who is fantastic. She's. Yeah. I feel like she's like one of those actresses who's just going to start
building.
Rising. Yeah.
She's terrifyingly creepy in this movie.
She is, but she's great.
Who else is on it?
Donald Gleason.
Right.
All right.
I said that right.
You did. Good job,
Dave. The first time ever. And Oscar Isaacs, who, in my opinion, is the star of this movie.
Oscar Isaac is a Cut Print Film favorite. And
yes. We love some Oscar.
Yes. And I really...
Put an Oscar between two buns.
And it sounds like hyperbole, but I really do think he's one of the best like working actors today, honestly.
I agree.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, after we left the movie, my wife was like, oh, that's Llewyn Davis? Like, oh my God, that guy's
fucking
amazing.
He does that to me every time I see him in something. He just... you forget that he was ever anybody else but the character you just saw him as. It's really incredible. Few actors have that quality.
It's like the anti-Tom Cruise, where Tom Cruise is, he's good, but he's always
he's
Tom
the,
Cruise.
Like the face of the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Oscar Isaac's slowly creeping up there to one of the best working actors.
Man, is he a good dancer.
Oh, God.
There's a scene in this film where he plays a drunken scientist, basically, and there's just one scene where he's just like, I'm going to... He just dances with his... he has like a silent assistant named Kyoko.
She can't speak English because she's Japanese.
Right, and so out of nowhere, he's just like, I'm going to dance, and him and Kyoko, they just start dancing out of nowhere.
It's a fucking disco, and like the lights
and
start going.
It's synchronized, and it's intentionally funny, but it's amazing. It's like it breaks up how dark the movie is.
Yeah, that scene in particular, that dance scene, is perfect, and it comes at the perfect time because you're just starting to be like, okay, this is a little too serious, and then this thing happens and it kind of pulls you back up out of that grimness.
It's a dark movie, but it's also really funny. Like, there's a lot of scenes where I wasn't expecting how intentionally humorous the film was.
Does this take place in the future, and if so, how far?
They don't say. I feel like it's like
that's
future.
That's what I'm getting at, because that haircut that Oscar Isaac's sporting in the trailers is
he has a shaved head.
And the beard.
Sort of, yes. He looks like one of the samurai from Seven Samurai.
Yes.
And it reminded me of like the odd fashion choices in Her, where it's like subtle and somewhat believable.
That's what it's like. Yeah, I would say it's like that. There's nothing like, I mean,
they never state when the year
I don't remember
is.
Them ever saying a year, but like the technology is obviously futuristic, but everything else is sort of,
I would say, not as far in the future as Her.
Okay.
Maybe only like 10
I believe
years.
This is set in the year Demolition Man was set, which was 1999.
That doesn't seem right. I'll look into it, though.
Okay. He's also a reclusive billionaire, so a genius, so his style is almost reflective.
He's pretty
of
much
that.
He's pretty much in like tank tops the whole movie. He's always Jeff.
He's
you would like
ripped.
Yeah, you would
movie.
Like this, Jeff, because almost every scene has Oscar Isaac getting a pump in. He's
See,
always.
I'm all about getting a pump.
He's always lifting weights.
I truly appreciate
hitting a heavy
of
bag.
Actors working out. It's excellent.
Yeah, and I got to speak with the director Alex Garland about this movie, sit down with him and talk about it, but we got fairly quickly into spoiler territory.
Right. But you can read that interview on cutprintfilm.com.
Yes, you can.
One of the things
in
I picked
Braille.
Up on was the Shining elements of it, and there's like an overall Kubrickian tone to it, and he kind of confirmed that with me that
yeah, I actually meant to get to see this film this weekend. I just couldn't get around to it.
You should definitely. If
we're
going to
dock your pay.
All right. Well, that seems fair.
If you have a chance, and I mean, obviously, it's not like we're ever busy. If you have a chance, you should definitely see it, because especially in a theater, because it played really well in a theater.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
this was on our list of most anticipated films of 2015.
Right.
And it was
sounds
kind
like
of
it's living
far
up
down
to,
there, wasn't it?
No, it was pretty high on the list, I think. But it sounds like it's living up to the hype.
I guess I saw a bunch of reviews going in, and I didn't read them, but I just checked the scores, and they were all like middling reviews, like sixes, sevens.
It's not getting they're mostly positive, but it's not as like raving as I feel like it should be, honestly.
Yeah, because so I was expecting just like a basic science fiction movie, but then it's this like very complex, and so there's like you were saying, these very subversive themes and
yeah,
and
there's
tones
so much going
it.
On. There's a lot about like.
Deception and
I would even say there's sort of like a feminism sort of thing running through it with the character, how it's all about how men perceive women.
Yeah,
like it's about a scientist who builds a female robot, and he didn't have to make it female, but he does, and there's a lot, I don't want to spoil, but there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, there's interesting ideas about just, you know, thought in general, mm-hmm. and how that controls us, and if we're programmed or not programmed.
Oh, that sounds great.
It's really it's an excellent film. I'd say this is already in my like top 10 of the year.
Yes, definitely. One of my favorites of the year, so you should go see it. And
I
I'm
like
pointing
it.
At Jeff.
Oh, I'm already going to see it, Dave.
Right.
How
now.
How do we point at the listener?
I'm trying, but it's not working.
When you point at someone, though, four fingers point back.
All right, so what's next?
I think we should reach into our Cut Print Film mailbag.
Oh, we have one of those?
Yes, we have a mailbag.
Oh.
We got a letter. It's a digital letter, but we did get one.
Hold on. Ding dong. It's the Cut Print Film mailman.
That's very professional production. I love it. Yeah, we got an email.
Oh, hey, does this help?
Wait a minute, Mr. Boseman. That's perfect.
Now we're getting sued.
Yeah, turn that up before we get a get a summons.
I had the Marvelettes actually come in and sing that for us.
Okay, then. It's a live performance.
I built a time machine just for that purpose.
Phil Spector's going to shoot all our heads off.
So we got a letter from a listener named Elizabeth. I won't divulge her last name. Because that would be rude.
Is it Elizabeth Bathory, the Blood Countess?
No, surprisingly, it's not.
Oh, that's
is it
good because
she
died hundreds of years ago.
No, these people have been dead for ages. This is an email from Elizabeth. She says, "My brother introduced me to this podcast a couple weeks ago, and it's been cracking me up and entertaining me the past couple of weeks. My brother is doing late-night feedings with his newborn twins, and you guys have helped him stay awake and entertained."
I wonder what he's feeding them.
Yeah, why would you eat that late at night?
Hopefully it's black and white milkshakes.
My fave.
I hear babies are like gremlins. If you feed them after midnight, more gremlins come out of their back. So this gentleman should be careful.
Yes, please be careful. We both started from the beginning, and listen, Elizabeth, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, please don't do that. Yeah, all new listeners, please don't start from the beginning of the Cutford Film Podcast.
We reluctantly started from the beginning.
Yes. If I had my druthers about it, we would have not have started at the beginning.
We both started from the beginning and are making our way to the most recent ones.
Wait, so she may have given up by now.
She threw her computer into the trash.
I hope not. She sent this email 2 weeks ago.
All right.
As a movie buff, I appreciate you talking about movies that aren't always mainstream, and I can expand my horizons a bit more from your conversations on various films. Keep up the good work.
As a buff movie buff, how do you feel about that?
I love this email. This is terrific.
Yes. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yes.
So, like, we kept our promise. If you write into the show, we will read it on air.
That is my favorite thing I've ever read.
Yeah.
Really? Ever? What about Madame Bovary?
Well, that's an excellent novel. So yeah, if you want to write in, ask us a question, say, "Hey Jeff, how much money do you make?" And the answer is surprisingly none of your fucking business.
You won't believe the answer.
But suffice it to say, I have had 3 sales in my Etsy shop this year alone, so I'm doing quite well.
Nice.
So yeah, email us info@cutprintfilm.com.
Jeff sells scarves for squirrels.
That doesn't make any sense. Also, you interrupt the email address, which is essential to this whole process.
dave@gmail.com.
info@cutprintfilm.com, or you can tweet at us @cutprintfilm, or send us a message like Elizabeth did on Facebook. Right. We are facebook.com/cutprintfilm.
Yeah, go nuts. And yeah, the nicer the email, or even the opposite spectrum, the weirder the email, you have a greater chance of us reading it on the air. If it's just, you know, "Great show," and that's it, we're probably not going to read that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not that we don't appreciate that, but I think you can do better.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying.
What we're saying is we believe in you.
Yes.
You need small character details like late night feedings and things
like that make me realize you are a real person and not a bot sending us bot messages.
We also need your bank routing number and your social security number.
Hi, Cutprint Film. What do you like to do?
Yeah. I can't tell you how many emails I get where the subject line is the secret to curing herpes.
Oh.
I get one of those daily in our Cutprint Film email account.
Well, what is the secret?
I've never read them.
Maybe you should.
I think it's Valtrex.
It's Val Kilmer.
I actually have one here, too, from a listener.
All right.
It says, "Have you guys ever seen Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa?"
You made that up.
What a coincidence, because that's what we're going to...
Jim in Gymland.
Oh, Gymland.
All right. It's so believable. we're going to be talking about Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai after the Kit Kat break.
Yes.
Coming up next.
Yeah.
Get yourself a Kit Kat, snap into it. Oh, that's a slim Jim. Sorry, whatever.
So we're going to break?
Yeah.
Why not?
Kiss each other's cheeks during the break?
Well, that's
okay,
a given.
If you want.
Again?
Get a 3-way cheek kiss going.
What's happening? Please, let's stop. Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutprintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons.
Think your Wu-Tang sword can defeat me?
On guard. I'll let you try.
by my Wu-Tang style.
Bring the motherfucking ruckus! Bring the motherfucking ruckus!
Yeah!
Yeah, we're bringing
it. Bring the motherfucking ruckus!
I can't wait.
That's my dead aunt's favorite song.
Yes.
Hey, Jizza, can you keep it down over there?
Yeah, because Jizza's in studio. Believe it or not.
Yeah, I don't believe it, and I'm here.
It's a complete lie.
Oh, right. I forgot. That's the RZA over there.
Nope. Nope. No, it's not.
We
Neither
are
of
back.
Them are in studio.
Dave's looking at a column in his basement.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We're here to talk about Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai.
That's right. This is part of our director series, which is where we pick a director, we pick three films that director made, and then we talk about those films over a period of three shows.
And every time we do this, I play this.
It's the Cut Print Film Director Series.
Action!
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
It's always funny to me.
I love it.
We should change it up. Be like, pass the Jolly Ranchers.
The Jolly Ranchers?
First of all, who eats Jolly Ranchers at the movies?
It's a whole box of them.
Second of all, it is Jolly and not Drolly.
We should pass the duds is what it should
be. Pass the duds. I hope they're all melted in your hand. I can lick them off your palm.
Put the duds in my pocket.
Okay, so we're doing Seven Samurai.
We sure are.
Last week we did Rashomon.
Seven Samurai singing. Last week we did nothing.
Oh, that's right. Last episode we did Rashomon. And this week we're doing Seven Samurai, which came out in 1954. And I would say that this is probably, of all the director series films we've talked about, this might be the most influential.
Absolutely. This is probably one of the most influential films I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of movies. Like, one time I watched Blame It on the Bellboy.
Yes.
What?
Yes, and I've seen The Dumbwaiter, a made-for-TV movie by one of our recent director series, Robert Altman.
Oh, well then.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, it's not very good.
We only watch hotel-themed films now.
That's our jam.
I feel like it almost goes beyond influential into a realm of opening up a new narrative form.
Yeah,
you know what
absolutely.
I mean? Like,
well, I was reading a film historian. He was talking about how other films had done elements that this film has, but no one except before Kurosawa had put them all together in one movie.
Yeah. And now we see them all together in just about every movie that's ever been made.
I mean, you want to know how influential this is? Even the recent Hercules with The Rock is clearly inspired by this film.
Yeah, but and we'll get into this.
It's like at one point somebody had eaten a lemon and somebody else had like had some meringue, but nobody had made a lemon meringue.
Who eats
pie
a lemon?
That's a terrific lemon meringue analogy.
Was it a pirate with scurvy eating this lemon?
No, one person, two guys had a lemon. One person just ate the rind of the lemon. The other person ate the drank the sweet juice of
one
the
of
lemon.
The, and ironically, one of those people, Jack Lemmon.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
You wouldn't believe it. It was a regular lemon party.
Anyway, we've run the course on lemon jokes.
Yeah. We're going to go over the plot real quick before we get into dissecting this film.
Right.
So Kurosawa's Seven Samurai came out in 1954, starring Toshiro Mifune, who we saw in Rashomon.
Right. Playing a very similar character here. The character who yells a lot.
Yes, Goofus.
I kind of like to imagine him as the same character, like the same
sort of
guy.
Yeah, he's now he's
post-trial
just
on the Rashomon case.
A little less rape in this one.
Yes. It also stars Takashi Shimura, Seiji Miyaguchi, and just endless great cast in this film. I'm not going to go over everyone.
We won't butcher their names anymore.
So, the plot goes a little something like this. Marauding bandits approach a mountain farming village, but having attacked it before, their chief decides to spare it until the next harvest. One of the villagers overhears this and warns the rest, and the farmers Manzo, Rikichi, and a timid old man named Yohai go to the village elder, Gisaku, who declares they must hire samurai to defend the village, otherwise they will be destroyed. Since they have nothing to offer but millet, he tells them to find hungry samurai, and the men go to the city to find samurai by offering them white rice and are shunned. They witness an aging but experienced ronin, that's a masterless samurai,
right.
Kenbei.
Kind of like a bounty hunter in Star Wars.
Sort of. Sort of. I mean, I know you're being a tomfoolery.
But yeah, basically everything Lucas got for Star Wars, he pretty much stole from these films. So yeah. You're not way off, Dave.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, this experienced Ronin Kenbe deftly rescues a boy taken hostage by a thief. Impressed, a young samurai named Katsushiro approaches him to become his disciple, and boy, is he eager.
Oh, yeah.
The village then asks for his help, and after an initial reluctance, Kenbe agrees. Kenbe recruits his old friend, Shichiroji? Boy, I'm going to butcher these.
Yeah. So again, we apologize. Yeah. We're dumb Americans.
And
Shichiroji.
With Katsushiro's assistance, three other samurai, the friendly and strategic Gorobei, the good-willed Hayahachi, and Kiyuzo, a taciturn master swordsman whom Katsushiro regards with great awe.
He's the badass of the group.
He looks like an absolute rock star. Yeah. This guy's awesome.
He doesn't say a lot, but man, he's good.
Though Kenbe had judged that seven would be necessary, time is short, so Katsushiro is taken as a sixth. And a poser named Kiku Chio follows. That's Japanese for 13, I believe.
Oh,
is what that is.
Okay.
Follows them despite attempting to drive him away. When
is
they
that
are
like a bad luck joke.
No, it's remember he presents them with his forged family tree.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And he says this is me right here. And
he's
they say,
13
well,
years old.
Well, this person is 13 years old, right. And you're clearly in your 20s.
Also, he's referencing the Danzig song 13. I
That's
believe.
Odd. That he would do that.
Believe it or not, you heard it here first.
When they arrive to the village, the samurai find them cowering in their homes, refusing to greet them. Feeling insulted by the cold reception, Kikuchiyo raises a false alarm to make them realize their need for help. The samurai are both pleased and amused by this and accept him as the seventh samurai.
I like this because all the samurai are really amused, but I was like, man, what a dick move.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're all just like, that was great. Good job.
I saw it from their point of view.
I feel like there's a lot of that in this movie where the samurai react a way different than you would react, but I think that's like intentional.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, maybe they live by a different code.
You're not a samurai, but I am. Oh. So I saw it from their perspective.
This is a surprising turn
of
events.
None of us were expecting that.
They accept him as the seventh samurai, but are angered when he brings them armor from samurai that the villagers have previously killed. Kikuchiyo then castigates them for ignoring the hardships, including harassment from samurai themselves. Farmers have to overcome to survive, which reveals his origin as an orphan farmer's son.
Such a good scene.
Oh, boy.
Because up it's until incredible. That scene, I was not enjoying this character. I was like,
I'm right there with you.
I was like, all right, this is a bit too much. But then
an about face.
Right.
Puts them all in their place.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great acting and writing, really. Mm-hmm. So.
The anger of the samurai turns to shame. The samurai and the farmers grow to trust one another as they train and construct fortifications together in preparation for the siege. Katsushiro forms a relationship with Shino, the villager Manzo's daughter. And boy, Manzo might be one of my least favorite characters in all of film
history.
Man,
he sucks.
Manzo's daughter, who had been forced to masquerade as a boy for protection from the supposedly,
the randy samurai.
They're awfully randy.
Yeah, for some reason, the villagers are convinced the samurai are just going to rape all their women.
Yeah, yeah, there's a line, our girls are crazy about samurai.
Yes. Yes.
It's like, oh, are they? Well then, let me shave half my head. As the time for the raid approaches, two bandit scouts are killed while another is captured and forced to reveal the location of their camp before he dies. Hayahachi is killed in a preemptive strike led by Rikichi on the bandits' camp, which is burnt. Well, that's another great scene.
Yes.
Further compounding Rikichi's sorrow. A woman emerges and kills herself in the fire, and it is revealed that she was Rikichi's wife who was stolen by the bandits and presumably raped.
Right.
The bandits then attack the village but are confounded by the new fortifications, including a moat, and several are killed attempting to cross them. Kenbe's successful stratagem is to whittle down enemy numbers by repeatedly letting one bandit through the gap and then killing him brutally.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Jisaku refuses to abandon his home on the outskirts of the village and perishes with his family, who die trying to retrieve him. A lone grandson survives, which sadly reminds Kikuchiyo of himself. The bandits possess three muskets, and Kiyuzo ventures off alone and returns with one in an incredible
badass
maneuver. Yeah.
He's like, gone all night, yeah. And he just comes back, and he just goes right to bed.
Yep.
He says something incredible when he goes away to get it, too, but I can't think of what he says, but it's just like this one succinct line, and he just disappears into the woods.
Mm.
He says, "Show me the money." I believe
that's what it is.
Swing away, Merrill. I think.
An envious Kikuchiyo abandons his post and his contingent of farmers to bring another of the muskets back to the camp. However, when he does this, he gives up his position and all hell breaks loose.
Right.
Several people are killed in the resulting attack from the bandits, and the next morning, in a torrential downpour, Kenbei orders that all of the remaining bandits be allowed in. Most are killed, but their musket-armed chief takes refuge, unseen, in the hut containing the village women, which is a nice full circle to the first time we saw Kenbei.
Right.
But this time, it is Kyuzo who goes in, and he is shot dead. A distraught Katsushiro watches him die, and he goes in and, enraged, kills the bandit leader, but he himself is also killed.
Right.
Kenji and Shishiroji observe that they have survived once again after all of this. Afterwards, the three surviving samurai watch the villagers joyfully planting the next crops.
Singing a delightful song.
Oh, God, yes. I really liked that song.
Yeah, I did too.
I was dancing around my living room.
I didn't go that far.
As you were planting seeds in your rug.
Nothing's going to grow. glancing at his buried comrade, Kenbei reflects on the fact that it is the farmers who are the true victors. And not the samurai.
God, that is a haunting ending where you see the graves on the hill and they have the swords in them.
All right, yeah, so, that last like scene of them planting juxtaposed with the samurai on the outskirts now is without a doubt my favorite part of the movie.
Right.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. This is an amazing movie.
Yes, this is one of those rare, I would call this one of those rare perfect movies.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, this is 10 out of 10.
Absolutely.
Yep, and it's a 10 out of 10 because not only are we saying it's great, apparently every director since
said this is a fantastic
film, that they all ape this film.
Right.
Everything from, like you were saying, Star Wars to films that came out shortly after this, The Magnificent Seven.
Which is like a direct remake of this.
Stuff like Ocean's 11, right. The Dirty Dozen.
Even just Westerns in general, like especially the Sergio Leone spaghetti Westerns are very much in debt to this film.
You got your Star Wars all the way up to
now.
I mean, of the Avengers.
Right.
Comic books.
Fucking
Pixar's A Bug's Life is actually an adaptation of this.
That is this movie.
Yeah.
I got a lot of Game of Thrones, like The Wall. Mm-hmm. All the stuff at The Wall is just this scenario, these marauders and like mixed in with people who can't defend themselves
it's incredibly influential. You can't say enough about how influential this film is. It's informed every Hollywood action adventure film since it came out.
But even at like a structural level, because I was reading that the scene where Kenbei goes and saves the baby initially, it's like the first time the hero was introduced like performing a task unrelated to the central plot.
It's a James Bond plot device.
I mean, this film, it has so many characters in it, and it's a long movie, but that length is necessary because it gives every character a chance to just develop and be rounded and
including the villagers.
Right.
Not only are we introduced to these seven samurai who all have distinct personalities and distinct reasons for doing what they do, and distinct fighting styles, but you're also introduced to several different villagers who are completely fully realized characters. You have the deplorable Manzo, who only thinks of himself. And
he's a real macho Manzo.
He sure is, Dave. You have Rikichi, who is, you know, heartbroken. He has a secret about his wife
Rafiki?
No, not Rafiki.
Oh. Timon and Pumbaa.
It's a regular Lion King.
Roar.
And you even have a great female character in Shino.
Yeah.
I love that. Like, I feel like any other movie, I'd be like, oh, get this love plot out of here. But I loved it in this. I loved how just it was because it slows the movie down, but I don't mind it. I got to say, this is one of the most brisk four-hour movies I've ever seen. Even though it's a long movie and it takes time to watch, the movie doesn't lull. It just keeps going and it moves.
Yeah, I'd say the first hour of the film is spent introducing the whole synopsis of the movie,
right.
The central theme. and introducing the samurai. The second hour is samurai come back to the village.
How many samurai?
Seven.
Oh, okay.
Seven of them.
Just making sure.
The second hour is the samurai come back to the village, and they train the villagers, and they make a plan. And then the third hour is literally...
battle.
Yeah, the battle.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, interspersed is the love story, and there's that scene where they've raided the villagers or the bandits' camp, and so I mean that makes up 3.5 hours.
It's pretty much
epic
the,
film.
It's like the same structure as Saving Private Ryan. I'm thinking about it right now.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
Everything
in the same vein of those too. Like the stuff leading up to the battle is more interesting than the battle itself.
Oh, I don't know.
No, I think the battle is fantastic.
I think the battle is absolutely riveting. I was really excited watching it.
One of the things I love about this battle, and just in the violence in general in this movie, I love is that it's ugly. And Kurosawa, he did that. He wanted to make a point that he didn't want to glamorize, you know, battle and war and violence. And I watch something like this, and I think of Zack Snyder's 300, where, you know, battle is the coolest thing. Yeah. Everyone's got their abs out, and they're fighting in slow motion. Yeah.
All the abs are soaking, sopping wet.
Everyone looks so cool, and there's hard rock music, and it makes me hate Zack Snyder so much more. That he just this is what he thinks. It's like, look at how cool fighting is in this movie, Seven Samurai.
It's messy.
It's ugly.
What I like is the dichotomy of the samurai fighting style, which is graceful and not ballet-like, but it's similar to old Japanese movies where the fighting was sort of like dancing.
It's choreographed.
Right. And then they train these villagers to fight, and even though they were trained by samurai, they're still just farmers, and so they're just messy, stabbing with these long spears. It's hideous to look at.
And it makes you feel bad for the bandits.
Yes.
There are several scenes where the villagers
it's a conflicting feeling.
They just start stabbing them to death.
They corner one bandit, and they're just – it's 20 –
it's like 20 villagers stabbing him with sawed-off bamboo spears.
Right. And even though the bandits were coming to, you know, rape and murder them, you just feel bad. It's like, oh, that poor bandit being stabbed by 20 guys.
It's very naturalistic, like, in how – it's clumsy, you know what I mean? Like,
and I can't even imagine filming something like this today. Piece of cake. You know, you CGI it, you green screen it. I can't imagine filming this in 1954 with practical cameras and effect. It probably was maddening to just set all this up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And apparently it was, because it took him a very long time to film this.
Yeah, they ran out of the production company ran out of money halfway through it, so... the director, Kurosawa, just said, okay, I'm going on vacation. When you come up with the money, I'll come back and finish the film.
Yeah.
And they did. They came up with the money, and he came back. But yeah, I think this is – it's great on so many levels, but the characters are so fantastic, especially, again, Toshirô Mifune playing Kikuchiyo.
Yes.
Ugh,
he is such a good actor.
His character is really something else. It's something out of a modern movie, really.
Really, yeah.
He's this wild card. It's almost like
everyone else is in the era. It's like the 16th century, but he's modern, which is like a great contrast. It's like he traveled back in time.
And he's pretty much comic relief for a lot of the movie, and it really does get old for about 45 minutes or so when he's just yelling. There's a scene where he's drunk and it just never ends. That scene is endless, where he's just stumbling over in the stable. But then literally right after that, once he's accepted into the group, he gives this great monologue about the villagers being...
They're stingy. They hide things.
Stingy and deceptive. And the reason they're like that is because of the samurai. And it's really, really heartbreaking. And there's a lot of facial acting and the inflections in his voice. It just sells the character right there on the scene, on the spot.
Absolutely. I was totally on board with this character as soon as that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really powerful, too, because it has like a symbolic meaning to it, because he was originally a farmer and is posing as a samurai. But in this scene, he's wearing like the legitimate... like the pristine samurai armor, the classic image that you see.
Yeah, what you
so
think
while
of.
he's damning samurai, that's what he's doing right in that scene. He's because he damns farmers. He's just it's just a very powerful.
He's
scene
the moral
because of how
compass of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Surprisingly, and you don't expect that. You truly do not. You expect him to be more or less like the bandit that he was in Rashomon.
You expect him
for
to
the
be,
first 45 minutes of the film. That's how he behaves.
You expect him to be like Bill Paxton in Aliens. He's Hudson. But it would be like watching Aliens, and then Hudson turns out to be the most relatable character in the film.
It's truly an about face.
He is Hudson. Yeah. That's great.
He's Hudson who becomes the lead, basically, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Hudson Hawk, I mean.
Exactly.
Bruce Willis.
Well, we all know what you mean.
So who's Newt in this scenario?
But yeah, you also have Kembe, who's, as you said, he's the first time a hero has done something heroic in the beginning of the film that has nothing to do with the plot of the film.
Right. I loved him.
He's a great leader.
His performance and just
a great leader. He's a born leader. He's a Ronin. He has no master. In fact, none of these samurais have masters.
Yeah, they are all Ronin.
And that kind of has something to say about Japan again, whereas prior to World War II, Japan was very buttoned up about serving the greater good.
Right.
And this film is more about embracing democracy and becoming your own person.
Right. I was reading that during the war, there were several samurai films that were made, not by Kurosawa, that were very much
traditional.
They were traditional, and they were sort of nationalistic and patriotic, where it's we're doing a duty for our country,
right?
And that's what Kurosawa wanted to do the opposite of that. Even though these characters, they're noble to a fault, I guess you could say. They're not
because of this film not approaching the samurai as being dutiful to their country,
right,
and embracing the idea of a democratic type outlook, that's why it played so well to Western audiences, because this movie was embraced immediately by American audiences.
Like, they're not just they're heroic, but they freely admit they hide when they need to. They're not like, they're not constantly like kamikaze just running in there.
Yeah.
And so that was,
it's a more relatable Japan is what this is. And
and they use like trickery and guerrilla tactics to kill. They're not like just standing there and slicing them down as they come by.
Yeah. They're not unstoppable robots, basically. Yeah, right. Or like perfect at what they do.
Yeah, I mean this is, it's just an incredible film. Even the dialogue is fantastic.
It is, yeah.
There's some poetic scenes.
God, just that scene where he says, and it's iconic now, but in retrospect, but where he's just like, "Find hungry samurai," like as the answer, like it explains the whole plot of the movie in three words, but carries all of this like symbolism of like Japan and how, like what you were just talking about, that like reverse nationalism, like hungry samurai. They're not supporting their culture in the way they should be.
Yeah.
And that's, it's fucking amazing.
And I mean, and the fact that this film takes place in the 1600s, which was, about when,
6 or 7 years before World War II?
No, that's incorrect, Dave. It's actually several centuries prior.
You're a bit off. Your math is fuzzy.
It was before the Shogun had, kind of brought the country together, and Japan was in a, reeling from a collapse of society in that time. So there were bandits, running the countryside, doing what bandits do. I presume stealing.
Yeah, running moonshine, I believe, in the General Lee.
No, that, I believe they drink sake.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And apparently sake was milky white.
Back then, that was confusing.
Boy, was
to
that
me,
putrid looking.
Where Toshio Mifune drinks an entire vase of sake.
Yeah, I did like that scene where he's mourning his boo-boo that he'd made.
I loved that. After the funeral, he just runs to the other hut. He just sits on the roof with the flag, and they just look at it. There's so many shots in this film that are breathtaking, especially a film from the 50s where it just took my breath away. That shot, and there's a shot where he shoots, or Kurosawa shoots the bandits coming up over the hill, and no one had done that before. Yeah. This is literally the first time any film had ever done that. And now, any movie with a army on horseback, that's all they do.
Yep.
But this is the first time anyone had ever filmed
that. There's some
that.
Really unbelievable shots. There's slow motion used when Kembe in the very beginning.
Oh, yeah, catches when he cuts the guy down.
The thief, yeah, that he cuts the guy down, and it's in slow motion. He falls to the ground, and there's no sound.
That's an incredible scene.
And yes, it is. Even that's shit you see in modern films where two people shoot each other, and you're wondering, oh, yeah. who got shot? And then the guy you don't expect falls down.
Yeah.
Is that the first time we saw that in this?
Probably.
Yeah. Slow motion like that? Yeah.
Can you guys go back and watch everything just to be sure before we...
Yeah, all right, I'll print this podcast.
It.
I'll go to the library and check every movie out.
Another great scene is when the one samurai, the rock star, goes and retrieves a musket from the bandits' camp, and then he returns through the fog.
Yeah.
That is another thing that we see time and time again now. I mean, this the movie... is just that influential that you could rattle off after scene.
I can't think of another film. It blew my mind as I was watching it to think this is every film I've ever seen in this movie.
What's crazy is that this is a Western.
Yeah.
I mean, this is in it's the style.
No,
yes, Dave, this is an Eastern. It sure is. It's in the style of every John Ford movie ever made.
Absolutely.
But the fact that it took a Japanese director to make a film so influential that it still is part of the conversation.
In fact, it is
the conversation.
It's weird,
overwhelmingly influential.
Yeah.
It's weird because, like, yeah, Kurosawa was heavily influenced by John Ford, but then everyone after Kurosawa was influenced by Kurosawa,
right.
Making Westerns, I mean.
I mean, people still reference John Ford as a point of influence, but come on. Let's not kid ourselves here. It's Kurosawa all the way for... every movie of the 20th century.
So 4 more years of Kurosawa? That's what you're
right,
saying?
Yes.
He's got my vote.
But yeah, it's similar to the way, I mean, we talked about this last week, but like Tarantino influences so many of the modern directors now, but that's just a callback to this stuff.
Yeah.
It eats itself. Yeah, it's
cyclical.
Almost like an evolution, if you will.
Yeah, I won't.
We'll have none of that.
Chris and I will both not do that.
We're creationists on this podcast.
But yeah, I mean, was there anything in this film that you particularly were struck by?
The opening scene where he pops out of the hay. There's these comedic moments.
Yeah, it's the look on his face. It's the look on his face.
That actor, I feel like, was the only, not going to say weak part, but he was the only thing that took me out of the film a lot. He's constantly making these faces.
Yeah.
They're like silent movie faces where it's like, oh.
And that's understandable because it's 1954.
Right, yeah.
Just generally in the beginning, I was slightly confused because then they tell them, and for some reason, it's just the whole town sitting in a circle crying.
Well, yeah, the villagers do a lot of woe is me.
Yeah, that scene was a little too much for me where they're going to come. No.
Yeah.
Everyone's crying.
Yeah, they're laying it on thick, and they do it constantly. Rikichi constantly complaining.
And then later at the one samurai's funeral, everyone's crying, and Toshio Mifune's character is just yelling at them to stop crying.
Yeah. I do like that there's full arcs. These villagers, they go from this crying mess in the very beginning to they're stabbing bandits with sawed-off bamboo spears. It's really great. It's really fully realized.
And then you see them in their true form at the end where they're
Decepticons.
Playing the bongo.
Yes, they're robots in disguise.
I love the way... it handles the passage of time. This film, it's actually the length, not actually watching it, but the setting of the film is the length of an agricultural year. And that's...
Oh.
So I looked that up. I didn't just pull that out of my...
That's incredible.
I'm not that smart, but I looked at... So, because basically the bandits say we're going to wait until the crops come in at the end. And that's literally how long it takes for the whole film to run out. And Kurosawa does these little things to show you the passage of time where...
There's a calendar just on the wall.
Yeah, there's a calendar, and the pages flip by. And there's a newspaper boy who says, "Extra, read all about it, governor."
Extra.
No, but the leader of the samurai, he shaves his head at the beginning of the film, and as the film progresses, his hair grows back slowly and slowly.
I didn't even pick up
on
that.
At the end of the film, he has not a full head of hair, but his hair has grown way back in. At the beginning of the film, he's fully bald.
That's right. Yeah, he shaves his head to pose as a monk
and even
save
that
boy.
Good catch,
even that is something for the film and for samurai culture is a big no-no. Samurais had a big thing about their hair and just the and it was called like a top knot they had in there. And there's a scene in the Tom Cruise film Seven. What the hell is it called? The Last Samurai, yeah. Where he's in the village and he sees like people cutting top knots off, and they're acting like it's a big thing. And that really was just this huge status. And if if a samurai lost his top knot, it was sort of like a sign of dishonor. And this guy, he freely cuts it off just so he can save this kid.
Well, and that's what makes him the leader,
right?
But yeah, this movie. I just can't say enough about it. It's one of the best movies I've ever seen.
It made me want to learn more about this history of Japan in general,
yeah,
because I feel very inadequately prepared for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
It made me wish Dan Carlin would do a whole series on samurai.
That would be great.
Them better.
Let's email him and ask.
Because I'm thinking, like, did other villages just have their own live-in samurai?
No. This is based on a true story, believe it or not, of a village that did hire samurai to defend them.
Okay.
In the 1600s.
So it wasn't a common thing for a village to have samurai.
No.
Okay.
No. And Kurosawa is actually descended from samurai, and that's kind of what inspired him to do this movie. Originally, he was going to do a film about a dishonored samurai.
It was
going to
be like over the period of one day.
Yeah,
or something.
And at he has to right a wrong that he made, and at the end of the film, he performs seppuku on himself.
Ooh,
I
love that it evolved from one day into a whole year.
Yeah,
in a film.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, and as he was doing research, he came across that story about the samurai being hired by the villagers.
Thank God he did.
Yeah, and we have this, and it's just unbelievable.
So I wanted to ask you guys about Seven Samurai. Have you guys seen that at all?
Magnificent Seven?
That's what I'm thinking. I'm sorry.
Okay,
yeah, obviously you have seen Seven Samurai because we're talking about it. The Magnificent Seven is the film I meant.
I last saw Magnificent Seven probably on Turner Classic Movies 10 years ago.
Dave, have you seen it?
I've never seen it. No.
All right, so after
Does it follow it beat for beat?
Well, yeah, so...
Radish for Radish.
Okay.
After I watched this, I said, let me go back and watch the Magnificent Seven, and that's a film that's regarded as a classic. And I remember, like, Jeff, I had seen it years ago, and I loved it as a youngin.
Yeah.
So I watched it.
Much like Donnie Darko.
Yes. So I watched it, and Seven Samurai actually ruins The Magnificent Seven for me because it's like a cheap knockoff where it's following Seven Samurai, but it does it in this dumb American way, which where basically all the samurai, they're all super cool, and they're, because one of the samurai is played by fucking Steve McQueen. So, obviously he's not a samurai, he's a gunslinger, but obviously he's going to be
Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen.
They're all trying to basically, swing their dicks around and show how much cooler they are, and it ruins it. And
does he pull up on a motorcycle?
Yeah, in the Old West.
That's odd.
He jumps over the border. And one of the things they did, which I really don't like in Magnificent Seven, is... Even though there are seven of them, they combine the young character from Seven Samurai, the young guy who's always fun, and Toshio Mifune's character. So he's like a young guy who's also
a badass.
Yeah, and it ruins that two perfectly good characters.
Yeah, and those are two very necessary character types.
And the actor playing it, I forget his name, but he's not like Steve McQueen, someone you remember. He's just someone who's just there, and it's like he sucks. I don't like watching this guy try to act like the Toshio Mifune character. And I mean, it's not a bad movie. It's, it's gorgeous looking. The soundtrack is phenomenal. And it has a great cast. James Coburn is in it when he was younger. And,
oh, wow.
Oh, okay.
It has this great sort of character actor cast.
I forgot all that.
Yeah. And I mean, it has cool moments in it, but I feel like if this were a film that existed without Seven Samurai, it would be
perfectly
great.
Fine. Yeah.
But watch,
Seven Samurai is already so American.
Yeah. It's almost unnecessary. Like, I literally watched this. I finished Seven Samurai. An hour went by, and then I put on The Magnificent Seven. Yeah. And it just I didn't want to even watch it. It was like, oh, this is not as good as it should be.
This is also Kurosawa's probably his most blunt film. Mm. It's pretty black and white. The good guys are the good guys.
Well, it is in black and white.
That's right, Dave. Thank you. The good guys are the good guys, and the bad guys are the bad guys. Whereas a film like Rashomon is, it's everything's blurred.
Right,
you don't really know.
Shades of gray.
Yes, exactly. 50 of them.
Yes. So how do you guys interpret that ending in general? The ending where he says, in the end, the villagers won and we'll always lose. So
I think it's like an attack on just the violence in general, like the way of violence. You know what I mean?
It can,
like,
this movie condemns violence, definitely.
Right.
And I think that's what he means by that. Their life, their livelihood is violence. Their business is killing. Whereas the villagers, yes, they had to defend themselves, but they can go back to, you know, planting crops and harvesting those crops and living.
Playing the bongos.
Whistling that song and just, you know, living their peaceful life as they should. Whereas the samurai has to continue this life of violence where the end result is murder. Event, you're going to die.
Yeah, I mean, they go from seven to three. And it's like,
did anyone, is this just me or did anyone feel just a tinge of like resentment for the villagers at the end there? Just a little bit. A
little bit, yeah.
Yeah, did you feel it or did I feel it in the characters?
No, me, personally.
I did. And he's kind of, the guy playing the drum is kind of given like this look that makes you kind of hate him. You know what I mean?
Like he's just like so smug about his drum song, basically.
Yeah. And it's also like the fields are being worked by all the women and the men are just kind of playing.
That's
flutes.
Another thing that took me by surprise, like that bothered me, that like it's just a bunch of guys dancing around while the women have to do all the work.
Whereas it was the men and the women fighting.
Yeah. Right.
There are scenes of women with spears killing.
And there's that guy's, what's the female character's name?
Shino.
Like he tries to talk to her and she just walks right by him. And it's like, oh, I want to talk about that scene where Manzo, what the hell's his name? Manzo? Yeah,
he catches them.
He catches them and he's just
beating his
furious
daughter.
And that bothered me. Not him beating her, because obviously he's a dick.
Because you're fine with that thing.
Yeah, obviously. I'm fine with dudes beating up their daughters. But what bothered me is that no one did any sort of like attempt to comfort. I don't know if that's just because I'm a modern person looking at it through the past, but like I really wanted at least the young guy or the head samurai to just put his hand on her shoulder, just something.
Yeah, I mean, Kenbe stopped it. He stopped the attack. And then there is the line about there's nothing wrong with young people being in love. And I think for 1954 Japan, that is incredibly progressive.
Yeah, I liked all that. That shot where everyone walks away and she's just on the ground alone in the rain.
Well,
just
he's standing there too in the foreground.
Right, but he doesn't.
He's doing nothing.
He does nothing.
But then it just cuts away. Like you don't even see him walk away.
Right. So
it doesn't cut. It's a swipe.
Yeah.
So every edit.
Kurosawa loves his swipes, which again is what George Lucas ripped off for Star Wars. But do you think that's implying that after it's swiped away, maybe he did go to her?
I don't know. I think that it's one of those things where we're not meant
not
to
meant
know.
To know.
Yeah, it's a tough one because that character, at the end of the film, he's left at a crossroads. Does he continue the path of the samurai that he was so eager to go on in the beginning of the film, or does he follow love?
Right.
And whereas in The Magnificent Seven, the character makes the decision to follow the path of love at the end, because that's an American movie.
Absolutely.
And it has to be.
Love always wins.
This is what happened. He did this, and this film leaves it open, but
do you think it leaves it open?
Yeah, I thought it.
Well, I mean, she blows him off, and so, I mean, you do see him walk off camera, but
and that plays back into what we were saying about the villagers really are the ones that win, because the samurai, it's a lonely life if you choose to go the path of the samurai.
Oh, there was another thing I loved. The test that he would do on the samurai.
Yeah,
when
they hit him in the head with a stick.
Incredible.
I love that.
It's incredible.
I can't think of an example, but that's something that gets repeated too, like that recruiting phase.
I'm sure. I mean, it wouldn't be the same scenario, but it's absolutely just taken from this.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's done in, you know, a comedic sort of way. That sort of,
It's just great how, like, this movie transcends language, because after, you know, a half hour in it, you're not even reading the subtitles.
Yeah.
It's just like, it feels like they're speaking English.
It also plays into the whole thing of the silent film acting that Toshirô Mifune is really good at. He just, you know, directs the scene through his acting, and you don't even need dialogue.
And
he's so expressive.
Seven Samurai.
A
swimming.
There's only so much you can praise a film, but
I'm sorry that I keep saying that this is such a great film, but this is an incredible film. You have to see this movie if you haven't already.
I mean, it's got the reluctant hero. It's everything you like in other movies. It's all in this movie, and this movie did it first, and it did it really well. This isn't like a case of oh, Kurosawa tried this out and then other people perfected it. He fucking perfected it right off the bat, which in itself is remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah, and like the dialogue works. It's not like, for being 1954, it doesn't feel dated.
And like, not in English. It's not like clunky. Sometimes when I read, when I'm watching a foreign film and it's translated into English, it doesn't work as well. You can tell that you're like, oh, I wish I spoke this language because this is probably great in that language.
That happens a lot with French.
Yeah.
It doesn't come across right, but I guess there's something with Japanese and English where they line up pretty well because these, I mean, this and Rashomon both, I've had no issue with the dialogue.
The dialogue has been, you know, flawless, I would say.
Absolutely.
So yeah, what's next for the Akira Kurosawa?
We are going to be talking about his film Yojimbo.
All right. I've never seen that either.
Me neither. I can't wait. It's going to be a good one, I presume.
And that's another film that has also just inspired several other films. Yep. So,
and I'm very excited to wrap up the Kurosawa director series, only because I just want to watch more Kurosawa films.
Yeah. So
yeah, again, while watching this one, I was like, oh, I have to watch more of these.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Just so you can cross-reference them all, because there's kind of callbacks to Rashomon in this, like the light, the way certain things were lit. Mm-hmm. You could see that in this, and it's just the incredible direction of Akira Kurosawa. Yeah.
And the sets. The sets are amazing.
All real.
Yeah.
He made them build those villages.
It's incredible. It's just a fantastic movie. Watch it. It's on Hulu. It's free.
All right.
Well, sort of free. So let's recommend some movies.
It's time for the cut print film for weekly recommendations. We do them every week on the show. And what? Oh, I'm sorry.
Forgot how long that was.
I had to dust that one off.
Yeah.
What?
So confused.
All right, who's going first?
I'll go.
Oh, good.
So my pick is a documentary which will be airing on HBO tomorrow. Well, actually today if you're listening to the show on Monday. It's called Tales of the Grim Sleeper, and it's from director Nick Broomfield. And it's the story of, for 25 years in South Central Los Angeles, there was a serial killer who killed over 100 women. But he was able to operate almost unobstructed for so long because all of the victims were poor black women, some of them prostitutes, and basically the LAPD just didn't give a shit. And we actually learned in the film that the LAPD at the time, they had this code name for, you know, African-American prostitute victims called NHI, which stands for No Human Involved.
Oh, wow.
So basically, these women would just get murdered and then just be like, well, whatever, they're prostitutes. We're not going to look too, like, they would obviously investigate, but they wouldn't look too hard into
it. Boy, is that horrendous.
It's an upsetting film. And so Nick Broomfield, he goes into like the projects in South Central LA. And at first everyone is like, they don't want to talk to him because he's this white British guy. But he's so laid back in his process that Adam, they just open up to him and he's able to get all this information out of them. And it's remarkable because he puts no effort into it. And all the police had to do was go talk to these people and they would get the answer they needed, but they didn't bother because it was just black people and they didn't care.
Wow.
And it's not like there's no like magnificent direction. It's very point and shoot, but it's a
great story.
Yeah. The story it's in that same sort of vein as like, you know, The Jinx and Serial, where it's a true crime story, but it's not about the crime, it's about the people who are all involved.
That's
in
fascinating.
The crime itself.
Do you get answers?
Oh, yeah. The guy who did it, he was arrested. He hasn't gone to trial yet. His name is Lonnie Franklin. And you learn all about him, and you learn about his son. And he had a wife, but his wife lived in another house, and she never knew anything about his murders. And basically, he would drive around in a, like an RV, like a trailer home, and just pick up, you know, young black women. He would offer them basically like crack or booze, and they would get into the RV and he would just murder them. And he was able to do this for 25 years.
Holy shit.
And he's believed to have killed over 100 women, and they could have stopped him so much sooner if they had just basically tried. And that's what this movie's about. So
that's insane.
It's going to air on HBO. I highly recommend you see it. It's called Tales of the Grim Sleeper.
The Crumbelievable.
Oh!
All right, I'll go. I'm going to recommend a movie that came out this year, actually last year, that Chris, you gave a good review for.
Oh, good.
It's starring Nicolas Cage. It's called Joe.
Oh, yes. This is a film that no one saw, and I wish they had.
Yeah, it's really, really good. And it like you said, to take your words, it reminds you that Nicolas Cage can act if he wants to.
Yeah, if he actually, much like the LAPD, if he would just try, he would get a result.
So the synopsis is a gripping mix of friendship, violence, and redemption erupts in the contemporary South in this adaptation of Larry Brown's novel. And I'm not going to read anymore. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's nonsense. But Nicolas Cage plays this guy who kind of has to protect this boy from a lunatic that he beat up in a bar.
Right.
And it's just really, really good. It's sweet. There's excellent performances. One of the boy's father is played by a homeless man who actually died.
Yeah, they found him on like train tracks.
Yeah, but he was played by an actual homeless man, and he almost steals the show.
He's
from Nicolas
so,
Cage.
Like when I was watching the film, I was like, "Who the hell is this guy?" And I looked it up, and I saw he was like, "Homeless guy." I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" He's like, so good in this movie.
This is an excellent.
That's how he's credited, homeless guy.
Yeah,
he doesn't even get a real name.
It's an excellent movie. Came out in 2014. It's on Netflix. It's called Joe. The Crumbelievable. Dave.
Gary Poulter was the guy's name.
Gary Poulsen. Is that what you said?
Yeah, the guy who wrote Hatchet.
Or Robert Paulson.
Yes.
From Fight Club.
Meatloaf.
Mr. Loaf.
That was his name. I'm going to recommend a TV show that I watched.
Get out.
But it's directed by the comedic duo Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Oh, everyone loves them.
They are famous for directing the 21 Jump Street series and the Lego movie.
Yes.
And they're going to do an animated Spider-Man movie because I guess we need that.
And they're funny guys. Like I'll
oh, they're
agree
talented.
With that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And they have talent. This show's called The Last Man on Earth. It stars Will Forte. And I wanted to hate it because I don't know why.
I watched the first episode. I hated it. I haven't watched any more. But you're telling me it's good.
The first episode's not the best. Right. But it's about this guy who's just like the title says, he just wakes up one day and he's the last person on Earth. And there's like a montage, a pre-credits montage of him just going around the United States, just collecting everything important and then putting it in one house and living there. And it's kind of like a fantasy, but then it turns into your standard TV comedy. But I just like the premise because it's kind of like, I feel like it's a comedic version of The Walking Dead. And I like that about it. And I like what Chris Miller and Phil Lord do with it.
One of the things I've been reading about it is that it's confusing people because the lead character is deliberately an asshole, and people don't like. They're like, "Oh, I don't understand why they made this," and like, he's not supposed to be a good guy. And I think people are not expecting that.
And that's kind of what I like about it because it doesn't go the way you would think it would go. Because eventually, someone else shows up, and it's a female, and you're like, "Oh, he would." Just love to. He's alone for literally like almost a year, and then within a day of being around this person, is like, "All right, you can leave now." Like he's an asshole, and that's it's cool.
I'll probably once it finishes, I'll probably watch.
Yeah, that's
the whole first season. But I just didn't like the first episode for some reason. But I've heard good things about.
Yeah, it's not amazing, but it's just like if you just want to sit back and watch some TV without like watching seven seasons of Mad Men to catch up. This is a good thing to throw on while you eat your briars out of your little briars
out of the whole
thing.
Tub.
Interesting.
Out of your briars thing. Do you have a special container for briars ice cream?
Yes. Hopefully it's a bedpan. So what's that show?
The Last Man on Earth.
All right.
Well, that's our show, folks, and we're sticking to it.
Yes.
Or we're not sticking to it.
Whatever. Sticky.
We're peeling ourselves off of it right now.
Yes, we're peeling our skin from our muscle.
Hey, you should check out some great websites like joystickjerks.com. They have a podcast about, I don't even know, what is it about, Jeff?
Bleeps and bloops and video games.
All right, and you should also check out antifanboy.com. They have similar aesthetics.
Yes.
If you don't ant your fan, they'll do it for you.
What was that?
Ant your fan?
Ooh, I wish I didn't ask.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. And as always, we encourage you, the listener, to go to iTunes and give this show a 5-star rating and a good review. It helps us out greatly.
Yes, it raises our profile, and Lord knows our profile needs raising.
It does.
The blind can't read it.
So,
do a 5-star review in your normal voice, and then do one like in a, you know, like
a silly goof voice.
Yeah, like,
wow, this is really cool. Five stars.
As always, you can check us out at cutprintfilm.com or on Twitter at cutprintfilm or Facebook, whatever, /cutprintfilm. Yes. I don't know how that works.
Be our friend.
Yeah, why not?
And like our page. He's a good boy.
Yeah. Next week, we'll be back with Yojimbo. Is that the film?
Yes.
Yojimbo.
And we'll be...
A cheesesteak baron.
And I guess we'll be talking about the Avengers, too. Age of Ultron.
Yes, he's 11.
Oh, I hope I got him a good gift.